So let's just start with a quick word of prayer, and then I will introduce Janet. Thank you, Lord, for today. Thank you that you are here, and that you are always present in our lives. We invite your Holy Spirit to guide us, to guide Janet as she presents her talk to us this morning, and just to bring unity around the tables, and that we might have fellowship with one another that is glorifying to you, and that we would be encouraged as we head back to our respective lives at the end of this morning. Pray this in the name of Jesus. Amen. Janet F. Buckingham is a lawyer who has traveled quite a bit over her lifetime already so far. And of course she has much life ahead of her, but she has been to England and studied and worked in England. She has been to South Africa to study. She got her degree, her doctorate, I believe, at the University of Stellenbosch in South Africa. She's also been to France, and of course she's been living in Canada for many years. And she is now in charge of the Laurentian Leadership Center. She's the director of that center, which is here on Metcalf in Ottawa. It is an extension program of the Trinity Western University, which is in British Columbia. Now, has anybody in this group actually seen or been inside of the Laurentian Leadership Center? Show of hands. Okay, we've got quite a few people who have been and who are, of course, aware of that center. There are currently how many students there this term?
23.
23 students who are there. So every 4 months we get a new batch of students from out west who come to Ottawa, who have the courage to come and live in Ottawa for 4 months and experience Ottawa culture, which is different, of course, than culture maybe back in British Columbia. And they get to work in the afternoon and study in the morning. And that is a huge influence on their lives and their academic career, and enriches their degree immensely by having had a chance to come to our wonderful city here in Ottawa. Now, Janet has been working for many years, and was working for many years with the EFC, and she, of course, provided her legal expertise to the EFC for many years, most recently as Director of Law and Public Policy from 2003 to 2006. And it was in 2006 that she joined the Laurentian Leadership Center as its director. So I guess that's 3 years now that you've been with them. And I trust that that is an ongoing commitment that hopefully you will be able to continue for many more years to come. So I don't want to take any more of Janet's time. I just wanted to remind you that today's topic is religious freedom in today's workplace, challenges and opportunities. And with no further ado, please welcome Janet.
Well, good morning.
Good morning.
I agreed to speak here. Ages ago, long before we knew that Canadian Human Rights Commission would be such a hot topic. So that alone, because it is the Human Rights Commission that governs all of you in the federal civil service, so that should provide some interesting fodder for questions, and I've already chatted with a couple of people about some of those issues. But I have lived and worked in the area of religious freedom for about 20 years now, both internationally. I've done lobbying in Geneva at the UN Commission on Human Rights, and I've worked really at every different level of government and dealt with a broad range of issues on religious freedom. And for people who are Christians, religious freedom is a really important issue in today's society. So I want to sort of situate us broadly, but then bring it down to the issues that confront us in the workplace on a regular basis. Now, I used to work directly in this area, and now I am an academic, which means that I get to comment on how, you know, I get to sort of write about it and study it, but I'm not as engaged on a day-to-day basis, but I do track with all of the current cases and issues. And really, employment issues are one of the huge areas in religious freedom, but there is a wide variety of other issues that are very topical, current, lots of issues going on in our society as we struggle, I think, with some new cultural realities. So, we're going to just go right through that.
There we go.
Okay, so the first slide. Our culture, we're dealing with secularization in our society. We're dealing with a pluralism of religions. Now, even though still the majority of Canadians would identify themselves as at least cultural Christians for the purposes of the census that we do every 10 years, we do recognize that culturally we are taught to think of ourselves as a multicultural, multi-religious country. We have political correctness, where choice is the highest value, and individualism. So there's this, you know, sort of a general ethos of you can't impose your ideas on someone else, and we all have to be very respectful of each other's beliefs. Now, that works in our favor, but it can also provide some challenges for us as well. The individualism, I think, has had a much broader impact than we realize. And when you look back on, I teach some history courses to my students and trying to help them understand the ethos during World War I and World War II when, you know, you were a community and there was duty and you did things for your country. Now we have much more, well, how does that impact on me and do I want to do that? People who are certainly, you know, 30 and under, the individualism is so much a part of their mindset that they can't even sort of think outside of that. But we did used to have, even in Canada, a much more community and I think even the broader community of national perspective that you sacrificed yourself and your own wishes and desires for a broader community. But individualism now, you know, with the me generation starting in the 80s on through, it's my ideas and my attitudes and what I want to do. And that sort of frames, I think, this idea of religious freedom. Now, we also have to remember that when we're talking about this new sort of, this has come to the fore with a human rights kind of approach, and I'm going to be talking a lot about human rights this morning, and human rights has changed our ideas and the way we think about things, because it's my rights, right? It's not my responsibilities and my duties, it's my rights. So that's sort of the cultural, the big picture cultural context that we're looking at. Well, following World War II, really, we did develop this global human rights consensus. And that came to the fore with a couple of international documents, and I'm just sort of framing the big picture that we have recognized, internationally recognized human rights. And this is at the United Nations level. This is from 1966, the UN Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. This is the smallest type I'm going to make you look at today. So if you find that a little bit small, nothing else is quite that small. But it's important to know that our religious freedom is recognized internationally. Everyone shall have the right to freedom of thought, conscience, and religion. This right shall include freedom to have or to adopt a religion or belief of his choice, and freedom, either individually or in community with others, and in public or private, to manifest his religion or belief in worship, observance, practice, and teaching. That's pretty broad, and I think that that can give us some confidence that that covers a lot of the things that we as Christians are going to want to observe. The second part of this, no one shall be subject to coercion, which would impair his freedom to have or adopt a religion or belief of his choice. Freedom to manifest one's religion or beliefs may be subject only to such limitations as are prescribed by law and are necessary to protect public safety, order, health, or morals, or the fundamental rights and freedoms of others. Now that's where we start getting into some of the conflicts between competing rights in society, and that's where a lot of religious freedom actually has been limited, is in the areas where there are competing rights. So in Canada, this was kind of followed up with the Bill of Rights in 1960 and then now the Charter in 1982. This is not quite as broad. This is actually kind of bare bones. And Section 2A of the Charter says everyone has the following fundamental freedoms: freedom of conscience and religion, freedom of expression. Well, that's not quite as full as what we see at the international level. And we'll see how, you know, that has left the courts really to interpret what religious freedom means. Now, the Charter applies to all levels of government, and it's supposed to limit government action in any type of restrictions on religious freedom. We also have in the Charter the infamous Section 15, the equality section, and some people say that this is the section that sort of eats up all the rest of the Charter. Every individual, see here this sort of individualistic approach, but every individual is equal before and under the law and has the right to equal protection and equal benefit of the law without discrimination, and in particular they have this whole list of things, one of which is religion, that we are not supposed to, as any religious adherent, face discrimination of our religion. Now, I include the Human Rights Act. Every province has a Human Rights Code, and at the federal level we also have a Human Rights Act. And the Human Rights Act covers the federal government. So if there is a problem for somebody who works for the federal government, it's under the Canadian Human Rights Act that you would look. And it says that it is a discriminatory practice, directly or indirectly, to refuse to employ or continue to employ any individual, or in the course of employment to differentiate adversely in relation to an employee on, it's in a different section, that all of the different grounds you're not supposed to discriminate on, but one of those is religion. So some of you may be aware that there have been a lot of controversies over the Canadian Human Rights Act and the Canadian Human Rights Commission, but I think it's important to recognize that this act also protects people. So, I mean, there are certain groups that are lobbying to have Human Rights Act and Human Rights Commission abolished altogether, but just before we do that, I want to point out that they do provide a certain measure of protection to Christians and other religious people, and do give us a forum for raising issues of discrimination if we face them in the workplace. Well, how do we know if we've been discriminated against? And we also have to be aware that somebody might come along and say that we are the ones who are dismissed. So, I said that it's really been the courts that have put some meat on the bare bones of the Charter. And when you look at what the Supreme Court of Canada said in the Big M Drug Mart case, which was the very first case. Now, this is really weird to have a case on religious freedom called Big M Drug Mart. Does a drugstore have a religious belief? Well, this was the first case to get to the Supreme Court of Canada after the Charter in 1982, and this case was decided in 1985, and it was, we used to have something called the Lord's Day Act, and stores were required by law to be closed on Sundays. That seems like such a long time ago now that stores were closed on Sundays. Well, Big M Drug Mart in Alberta decided that they were going to stay open on Sunday to challenge this law. So, of course, they were charged with being open on a Sunday in violation of the Lord's Day Act, and the act was, in fact, struck down. But it gave the Supreme Court the opportunity to say what religious freedom was. Now, the irony of this is that there was not one single religious person who participated at the Supreme Court of Canada level in this case at all, because at that time, the Supreme Court had very limited ability to intervene. So if you watch the Supreme Court now, you see groups lining up to intervene in cases, and the Supreme Court, when there's a big important social issue case, there's all kinds of people lining up to intervene in the case and make arguments. But at that time, in 1985, there were not broad intervener provisions, so there were no religious groups that were actually there, which is too bad. But still, the court came up with, I think, a very good and broad definition. You may recognize some of the language. It sort of echoes the international, the UN Covenant on Civil and Political Rights language. The essence of the concept of freedom of religion is the right to entertain such religious beliefs as a person chooses, the right to declare religious beliefs openly and without fear of hindrance or reprisal, and the right to manifest belief by worship and practice or by teaching and dissemination. That's a nice broad definition, and you know, when you consider the nature of the case, it's a little bit, it was obvious that the Supreme Court was taking the opportunity to set this broad framework. They actually went on in the case to talk about that second part of the UN Covenant on coercion and saying that no one should be coerced into religious practices. And on that basis, struck down the Lord's Day Act because they said that it was coercive to non-believers to be, in a sense, forced to observe the Sabbath by not being able to have shops open on Sundays. So I give that to you for background because that is doesn't really terribly impact on the workplace, but it's important to know what the sort of broad framework is, because that little section is quoted in every single religious freedom case from then till the present day. That's always sort of the basis. So now we get into the actual workplace situation. And the first and important case in this area, 1985 was a banner year for religious freedom cases, because here is the first really significant case from the Supreme Court of Canada. And it was under human rights legislation. So it was under a provincial, it was under the Ontario Human Rights Code. O'Malley converted to being a Seventh-day Adventist, and they practice a Saturday Sabbath, and that is sundown on Friday until sundown on Saturday. Well, Mrs. O'Malley worked for Simpson Sears, which is what Sears used to be called. We used to have Simpson Sears, large department store. Now, you remember in that time, stores were not open on Sunday. So when Mrs. O'Malley goes to her employer, Simpson Sears, and says, I now want to have Friday evenings and Saturdays off, that's the busiest shopping time of the week, because they can't just sort of substitute Sunday for Saturday because they weren't open on Sundays at that time. So this was a big deal, and you can understand why Simpson Sears says, if you don't want to work on our busiest shopping day of the week, then you're going to have to go to part-time instead of full-time, because that's just not going to work for our scheduling. But she went to the Ontario Human Rights Commission. This case went all the way from there up to the Supreme Court of Canada. And this established the principle that an employer has to accommodate an employee's Sabbath or religious holidays, and they said, up to the point of undue hardship. Well, now that there is also Sunday shopping available, that has had a much larger impact on a broader range of religious believers, because there are many Christians who would like to have a Sunday Sabbath recognized. And so this set this principle that religious people should be accommodated. Now, those of my friends who work in retail say, if you want to ask for a particular weekend day off every week, who will be blackballed by your fellow employees. So there are some realities of the work situation that everybody may hate you where you work if you ask for your religious freedom rights to be recognized. But they are there in law, even if people find it uncomfortable to actually practice those. Well, moving on, it is interesting to see that another case, just a few years later in 1992, another Seventh-day Adventist case. Seventh-day Adventists tend to be very strong both in Canada and around the world for having their Sabbath recognized. They take their Sabbath very seriously, and they must have it off. So they actually have whole legal organizations that work internationally to recognize Seventh-day Adventists. So they will, that's how a school janitor can take this kind of case up to the Supreme Court of Canada, because often people don't enforce their religious freedoms or don't fight for their religious freedoms because it's complicated and expensive. I mean, how many people can afford to go out and hire a lawyer and go up all the way up to the Supreme Court of Canada? Probably cost $500,000 to take this case all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada. In this case, we had a school janitor who wanted to have, he needed to be off in time to be at home by sunset on Friday. And so he went to his school, asked for this, asked to be accommodated. In this particular case, the school was willing to accommodate the janitor, and his union said no. His union didn't like this idea that one of the union members would be being treated differently than other union members, and so they refused to approve it. And this set the principle that unions are also required to defend, not only respect and agree with, but actually they said the union should have taken this as a grievance to the school, and the unions are required to defend the religious freedom of their employees. Which is quite significant, because you think about some of the unions that our federal civil servants belong to, and some of them are not known for being terribly amenable and open and happy with things like religious freedom. That's sort of my impression of some of them, with having had run-ins with them on particular issues. And this set an important principle that, hey, that's part of the role of a union, and they have to do this. Well, just to give you an idea of where some of the current cases have been on accommodation, our Supreme Court of Canada has been very strong in general in recognizing religious practices and requiring accommodation of religious practices. So this was a fairly recent case out of Quebec, Syndicat Northcrest and Amsalem. There have been a number of legal issues in Montreal between Orthodox Jews and different people and groups. Now, Montreal has a fairly large Orthodox Jewish population, and they are different. They are the people that you see that will, you know, always wear hats. The men tend to have these long ringlets in the front. I actually was at an airport in Poland near Auschwitz, and Orthodox Jews do pilgrimages to there, and a whole group of Orthodox Jewish men came into the little waiting area where we were waiting for our plane and started their afternoon prayers. And they were, you know, putting on prayer shawls and strapping things on their forehead and arms, and the man beside me was just, he looked panic-stricken, like, what are these people doing? And the point is that they have very visible practices, and they're different than the rest of society, and they don't assimilate. And so their neighbors feel uncomfortable with this, and they get irritated with it, and, you know, why are you, you know, always doing things differently and you don't act like us? So in this particular situation, there were several Orthodox Jews living in some very nice, wealthy, high-rise condominiums in a very nice part of Montreal. And when it came to a holiday called Sukkot, they wanted to build booths on their balconies and live outdoors for a period of 9 days in accordance with Scripture. Well, the other people who lived in the condominium didn't want them to be building these shelters on their balconies out of, you know, plywood. They thought it didn't look very nice and it diminished the value of their condominium. And according to the condominium agreement, you weren't allowed to have anything on your balcony. But the Supreme Court of Canada said that religious practices should be accommodated wherever possible, and that other condominium owners would just have to give way to this. So this is the type of case. It was actually a private property case. There was a condominium agreement, which you're supposed to have read and agreed to ahead of time, but the Supreme Court of Canada said, no, these are important religious practices, and religious freedom is a very high value in our society, and these people should be accommodated. Another one out of Quebec, these issues seem to be coming up in Quebec a lot fairly recently, a Sikh boy was expelled from school. It's not uncommon these days to have a no weapons policy in school. But a part of the religious beliefs of Sikhs is that men are to wear a kirpan, a small ceremonial dagger. So Multani was out on the playground, well, I mean it was a high school. Is it still a playground in high school? Out on the grounds of the school. And his kirpan, his small ceremonial dagger, fell out of his pocket. Shock and horror. He was immediately expelled. And so what do you do in this situation where you have a religious belief conflicting with a reasonable school policy? It is a totally reasonable policy. We don't want our kids to be going to school with weapons. We don't want other kids to be at school with weapons. And I don't care if it's ceremonial. If it's got a blade, we don't want it in the school. The Supreme Court of Canada said that this should be accommodated. Now, it's kind of interesting because there are, in both the Jewish case and the Sikh case, there's a whole variety of religious practices of that group, like there are for Christians. You know, some Christians find it's, you know, I absolutely am not going to be working on Sunday on the Sabbath, and other ones will. And you know, how we dress and what we do, there's a variety of practices. Same for Sikhs. For some Sikh groups, the men will wear around their neck a little necklace with a little plastic dagger on it. And that's sufficient to meet the requirements of wearing the kirpan. But for this boy, he needed to wear an actual dagger. So the Supreme Court has had to wrestle with this. You know, for some of the Orthodox Jews, it is sufficient if they have down on the ground kind of a communal area where they can live outside and take their meals for Sukkot. And for others, no, I need to actually have it in my home and on my balcony. So the Supreme Court has had to wrestle with this idea that all religious believers of a certain belief don't follow the same practices. And what the Supreme Court has said here is individualism is paramount, and people need to be able to practice the religious beliefs that are important to them. And you don't even have to be consistent. So if you have for 10 years not asked for Christmas Day off, and then you say, you know what, Christmas Day has become really important to me, and I really need to have it off, and your employer says, oh, what? How have you come up with this? Well, I'm taking my religion more seriously. The Supreme Court is now saying that's okay, and your employer now has to start accommodating that. You know, you are allowed to change your practices, you're allowed to change your religion, and your employer should accommodate it when you go to them with a reasonable request. Part of it with the Sikhs was that there was no evidence that any of these weapons had actually ever been used in a school situation or anywhere in Canada for violence purposes. The courts have also been very strong in protecting what I call conscientious objection, where employees have refused to do certain things at work or asked for accommodation. And some of these I find, you know, wow, I'm surprised that the courts and the Human Rights Commissions have said that these should be accommodated. So I'm happy to see that they have, because this one I think is quite significant. In a Newfoundland hospital, they suspended a clerk because she refused to sell tickets. Now, you know how in a workplace you can have like fundraising raffles and different things going on. So this was not actually part of her hospital administration, but as the admin assistant, she was supposed to be selling tickets within the hospital staff to other staff members to a social event at which liquor would be served. She was a teetotaler, and she said, I don't feel comfortable selling tickets to an event where liquor is going to be served. And so the hospital suspended her because she wasn't performing her duties. She went to the Newfoundland Human Rights Commission, and they said, you should be accommodated. The hospital is wrong to suspend you for refusing to do something that violates your religious beliefs. Well, are all Christians teetotalers? No. But they said, this one is, and that's part of her religious beliefs, and she should be accommodated. Many of these cases actually settled, so there aren't, you know, actual decisions about them. But they settled because a human rights commission somewhere in the country said, employer, you need to accommodate the religious beliefs here. Down in Stouffville a few years ago, this was more than a decade ago actually, the Stouffville General Hospital started to require all their obstetrics nurses to assist with abortions. So obstetrics nurses are delivery room nurses. They help deliver babies. And so this was a change for the nurses to now not only deliver babies, but also assist with abortions. So there were 8 nurses that were obstetrics nurses in that hospital who refused to assist with the abortions, and all of them were told that they either had to go and work in other departments in the hospital, or they needed to go find a job elsewhere. So they brought a human rights complaint to the Ontario Human Rights Commission, and the case eventually settled. By the time it settled, all of them were working elsewhere by that point. But they did eventually agree to change their policies to accommodate nurses who had conscientious objection. Now again, the nurses said, no nurse likes to assist with abortions. And so when they refused on their religious beliefs, that left the other nurses in that area having to do way more abortions. So there was a lot of internal resentment. So that's actually why some of those nurses decided to move elsewhere, because they just found it too difficult a work environment to work in. But for nurses who were trained in obstetrics to then be required to go and, you know, go and be an emergency room nurse or a palliative care nurse, it was outside their expertise, and so they did have to make some real sacrifices if they were going to change. But it was ruled that that was a legitimate conscientious objection that should have been accommodated by the hospital. This one I found a very interesting case, and there was actually a tribunal decision on this. Shoppers Drug Mart required one of their staff members to arrange a display of poinsettias, and he refused on the basis that Jehovah's Witnesses do not observe Christmas. Now, as we know, poinsettias are only fairly tangentially related to Christmas. So I was a little bit surprised to see a tribunal decision saying that Shoppers Drug Mart should have accommodated the Jehovah's Witness and not required him to arrange the poinsettias. Now, I mean, I know that courts and individuals struggle to figure out, well, where does this end? Does it now mean that if you're actually at the till you don't have to sell poinsettias or Christmas decorations to anyone, and that would get extremely awkward around the Christmas season in retail because, of course, a lot of people are buying that kind of thing. But this is how far, and actually these kinds of cases have raised some criticism of human rights commissions, but I think it is really difficult for courts and tribunals to figure out what is a legitimate religious belief and what isn't a legitimate religious belief. However, in this particular case, they said, you know, he could have been accommodated, so he should have been accommodated. This is another interesting case where an employee was part of a, I would call it a Christian sect, because I hadn't actually heard of this group before, but they consider themselves Christian, but they also observe the new moon. And I guess on the basis of the Old Testament, this particular employee wanted to have every new moon as a holiday. And he worked for a youth services program, and they fired this employee. It was actually still during the probationary period. They fired him partly on the basis that he had taken a day off that was not an authorized day off. And the tribunal did rule that it was discrimination on the basis of religion. However, the employee's performance had also been very poor, so you know, the youth services program was not required to rehire him and did not have to pay very much compensation to him, but they did rule that even, you know, a very sort of minor and tangential sect religious belief should be accommodated where possible. But there are a few cases where accommodation has not been made, and one of these is for marriage commissioners. Now, we don't really have these in Ontario, but particularly out west, from Manitoba west, they have marriage commissioners who perform civil marriages. In Ontario, it's usually judges and municipal clerks that do that kind of work. But they have designated marriage commissioners, and you can apply to be a marriage commissioner and get the a marriage license from the province to solemnize civil marriages. But these provinces have required their marriage commissioners to solemnize same-sex marriages without discrimination, even for those who are have religious beliefs that would prevent them from doing that, because some of these people are actually retired clergy who do this as sort of a retirement project, still do civil marriages. So the argument on the part of the provincial government is that these marriage commissioners are acting as government officials, and therefore they don't have to be accommodated, because you've seen, boy, you know, the courts have really bent over backwards requiring that employees be accommodated in their religious beliefs. So why suddenly does this one group of employees not need to be accommodated? So I raise this because they're making the argument that government employees are different when they're providing services to the public. And when you are a government employee, you're sort of standing on behalf of the government, and therefore you must provide whatever services you do without any discrimination, you know, no matter what your religious beliefs are about the particular issue at hand. So that's pretty important to know if you are a government employee, that suddenly your religious beliefs may not have to be accommodated in certain. Another case that seemed a little bit odd and may signal a bit of a shift on the part of the Supreme Court was a recent case involving Hutterites. Now, we don't have Hutterites in Ontario that I'm aware of, but any of you who are from the prairies originally, Hutterites live in colonies and hold their property communally. They farm, but unlike, you know, those, if you are aware of Amish or Old Colony Mennonites, they are horse and buggy people. Hutterites are not. They have like the latest in technology, and so they are farming, they drive machinery, They drive on the roads, but they have strong religious beliefs, and they believe that getting a photograph taken violates the second commandment in the Bible. And Alberta, back in 2003, started requiring photo ID on your driver's license. So in order to get a driver's license, you have to have your picture taken. Well, this obviously is going to create a conflict. Hutterites either can no longer drive, or they have to change their religious beliefs. So the cases up until now would have led one to believe that the Supreme Court would have accommodated this. So it was a bit of a surprise to see the Supreme Court saying, no, they don't need to be accommodated, and this is maybe an inconvenience for them, but they can hire drivers, there's other things that they can do. This is not a serious violation of their religion. So I'm not sure what this signals, other than we do have a recent situation where a group was not accommodated. So we'll see where that goes. Conscientious objection and taxes. This has been another interesting area where particularly Quakers started this little trend of diverting the percentage of their taxes that reflects the Canadian military budget. And they actually have in the Quaker community a peace tax fund that they will divert their taxes into this peace tax fund. Mrs. Pryor has been fighting this for years. She's even gone to the United Nations with this issue, and she, to my knowledge, still has not paid that portion of her taxes, despite the fact that this case was in 1989 and she lost it, and the government said, well, you know, we don't do taxes. It's not like your personal taxes are divided up in accordance with the government budget. There's also now, and I was trying to find his name recently. This has been an ongoing issue. He's out in the Maritimes. Pryor's from the Maritimes as well, so this diversion of taxes is sort of a maritime thing at the moment. He's been diverting his taxes on the basis that the government funds abortion, and he's raising this as an awareness-raising issue, but he's also not paying his taxes on this basis. And I think you can see that, you know, the Quakers have already lost this issue, and I don't think he's going to win this issue. So conscientious objection does not apply to your taxes. Now, just sort of raising some other issues that are sort of a little bit more broadly, and I'm then going to start applying some of these to your specific situation. Chamberlain was a really interesting case out in British Columbia. The cases are now all coming out of Quebec. They used to all be coming out of British Columbia. And the Chamberlain case was a situation where a gay teacher had tried to get some books approved for classroom use that were storybooks that featured same-sex parents. Surrey is a religiously diverse area, but has a very strong Sikh population, Muslim population, and evangelical Christian population who all objected to having these books introduced in school. And the Surrey School Board, when they were considering this, ultimately decided not to approve the books, partly based on the objection of the religious parents. Well, then the teacher who had initially asked that the books be approved challenged that in court, saying that schools in BC, under legislation, are required to be run on a strictly secular basis. That's in the legislation. And so the views of religious parents could not even be considered. So they should be, all of those views should be completely excluded from the debate. And it raised the issue of, now, under religious freedom and freedom of expression, shouldn't religious parents have the same rights as everybody else to participate in public debates on significant issues? And that is, in fact, what the Supreme Court ultimately said. But at the first level of court, they agreed and said, yeah, you're right. Strictly secular means that religious people should be excluded. Now, from there on in, the court said, no, religious parents have a right to participate in public debate the same as anybody else would. But they did put this little limitation on that said religious parents' concerns cannot be used to exclude another protected group, in this case, gays and lesbians. So you can't say, because of my religious beliefs, you have to exclude this other group. And that works between religions, too. So a Christian group wouldn't be able to go into the public school system and say, the views of Muslims should be excluded or the views of Jews should be excluded because they conflict with my beliefs. So in some ways you can see how this is a good thing, but in other ways it does seriously limit the ability of religious people to have their views considered in the public square. We haven't seen very many, I mean this may have been a unique kind of situation, but it does have an impact on how Christians can participate in the public square. Another issue of concern is this new trend that we're seeing of where professional bodies are involved, and in this case, Kempling was a teacher in British Columbia, and he was disciplined for writing a letter to the editor on how gays and lesbians were being treated in the school system. He objected to how, you know, certain groups seem to have no limitations on them. So he wrote a letter to the editor that was considered demeaning to gays and lesbians, and he was disciplined on this sort of catch-all phrase that is in a lot of professional codes of ethics, of conduct unbecoming. And that's, you know, teachers, lawyers, doctors, pharmacists, anybody who comes under a code of conduct that's regulated by a professional body, accountants, it does seem to censor what these groups can say. And that, of course, can involve your workplace conduct or your conduct outside the workplace. So my last, actually it's not my last, it's my second last issue. Restrictions on religious expression. This is really where the human rights commissions have gotten into some hot water, is on their treatment of expression. And there have been a number of different situations. Bishop Henry in Calgary with a pastoral letter, Pastor Boisson in Red Deer with a letter to the editor in the local newspaper, Ezra Levant with publishing the Danish cartoons in the Western Standard magazine, and Mark Stein with an article called America Alone in Maclean's magazine. And these all attracted human rights complaints because certain human rights codes, including the Canadian Human Rights Act, have a provision about that prohibits publication of things that can be demeaning or discriminatory against certain groups. And that's very broad, and there are a lot of groups that are saying freedom of expression is protected under the Charter, it's very important to Canadian society, and so these kinds of restrictions should not be being allowed. Moving into freedom to preach in public, the reason I include this in an employment situation is because these kinds of situations of, you know, most of us are probably not going to be, you know, going to our local town, putting on a little play or something in the context of our workplace. But we could be, because there are certain times where, for example, in schools there's been, you know, prayer around the flagpole. There have been principals that have told kids they cannot meet in front of a school and pray, even silently, because it's against the law. So there are times when, you know, I would think about things like, what if your group wanted to sing Christmas carols in the lobby of where you work? Just, you know, one day at lunchtime, you want to just bless people by singing Christmas carols. Is that a violation of, could be a violation of any number of policies? And you think, isn't that pretty innocent? But there have been these kinds of issues come up, and there may well be policies like this one in Pictou in Nova Scotia, where Anything religious is considered to be controversial, even if it's Christmas carols. It's considered to be controversial, and there can be different kinds of restrictions. In this particular case, loitering. These people were not loitering, they were putting on a play. That doesn't sort of fit in my conception of loitering. But he did win that there was, that the policies were discriminatory there, and that he should be allowed. So, you know, many of us may not want to fight that. If what we're trying to do is bless people, you don't want to get into a battle with administration on that. But just to let you know that these kinds of things can be, can you can face more restrictions for singing Christmas carols than you think you would. And what starts out as a blessing may turn into some kind of argument. So this is the last issue that I'm dealing with, and that is union dues. And this was a case involving PSAC, and Mrs. Comstock wanted to divert her union dues because she disagreed with PSAC's support of same-sex marriage, and she lost that case. I know a group that is still trying to keep that issue alive to say that union dues should be able to be diverted to another organization, because some of the unions have become very political on certain issues in ways that do violate your religious beliefs. And Mrs. Comstock felt strongly enough about it to try to divert her union dues, but that has so far not been allowed by the federal court. So I just sort of raise that as one other workplace issue. Well, where does that leave us at the end of the day? Well, it leaves us recognizing that there are rights protected in law to be accommodated. And I want to just indicate that there are realities of where you work. And, you know, we all want to get along with people. And so one may not want to actually enforce one's rights. But at a certain point, I think we do need to stand up and say, look, you know, we should be treated equally, we should be accommodated in our religious beliefs, we shouldn't be coerced into doing things that violate our religious beliefs. And these are things that I am not as individualistic, that I say, you know, it is important to be part of larger fellowship groups so that we have groups that we can test out our ideas and say, is this, you know, is my employer going too far in saying we can't do this, you know, that we should not be accommodated. I mean, all I'm asking for is 1 hour a week to go and meet with a Bible study group, or, you know, the ability to meet in one of our offices to have a Bible study. You know, shouldn't this be accommodated? What is the problem here? So we do have this sort of general right, and we need to use it carefully and wisely. But I'm encouraged that the courts have strongly protected religious practice, and so we can build on that to say that we do deserve respect and accommodation in our workplaces.